ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This is the NT Country Hour on ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
G'day there, my name's Matt Brown. Welcome to the program. There's been a big shake-up at the top end of Tamboran Resources. The chief executive is gone, and a Texan oil and gas heavy hitter has entered the boardroom. What could all of this mean for the Territory's Beetaloo Basin?
I think you will see them bring a much more American lens to the Australian oil and gas sector in the Northern Territory.
Also today, an update on how the Territory's cotton harvest is going and a look at how a deal came about to sell Droughtmaster heifers from the Alice Springs region to the Philippines.
The purchaser was very strong on his selection criteria. The cattle shaped up very well, were very well bred, and a credit to the breeders.
All these stories and plenty more coming up on today's Country Hour. Hope you can stick around. We are broadcasting right across the Territory on the ABC, and a reminder, if you need to duck out to the paddock for whatever reason, or maybe you're about to run out of a reception on the highway, you can always download the podcast and listen at a time that suits you. Our top story this afternoon is that just after 4 months in the job, the National Farmers Federation Chief Executive, Troy Williams, is gone. In a statement from the NFF, it said Troy Williams has tendered his resignation as Chief Executive of the National Farmers Federation. The board has accepted his decision, which was made for personal reasons. We thank Mr. Williams for his contribution and wish him the very best for the future. Troy Williams, he started in March. I'm pretty sure he's never been on the Country Hour, so no interviews done, not much from him, from what I could tell, and now he's gone. Leader of the Nationals, David Littleproud, was just on ABC Radio and said he was a bit surprised by this news.
I'd met him in passing once, and ironically, I was to meet him this afternoon with the president of the NFF here in Parliament House. So I suspect now it'll just be David and I. So I don't have an intimate knowledge of the workings of the NFF, and nor should I. And obviously, I hope that no matter the circumstances, they can appoint somebody else and make sure that they provide good representation for the agricultural sector.
Yep. So after just 4 months in that job, Troy Williams has resigned as Chief Executive of the National Farmers Federation. The NFF President, David Johinke, he was unavailable for an interview today with the Country Hour. I think it's fair to say the NFF is going through a challenging time at the moment. In the last 12 months, organisations such as New South Wales Farmers, the Victorian Farmers Federation and AusVeg have all given notice that they are quitting the NFF. Who will be the new chief executive? I guess we'll have to wait and see. Meanwhile, Tamboran Resources is also looking for a new chief executive after announcing yesterday that Joel Riddle has stepped down after 12 years in that top job. The gas company has also announced changes to its board of directors, with Texan oil and gas heavy hitter Scott Sheffield appointed as a non-executive director. Analyst Saw Kavanick says changes at Tamboran are significant for the Northern Territory's gas sector.
Well, first of all, there's obviously a lot of diverse opinions out there on the Beetaloo development, the economics of it, the environmental impact of it. But whatever your thoughts on that, Joel Riddle has persevered through very difficult times with a small company to get Tamboran to a stage that many skeptics, including myself, never thought they would be able to get to. And so, you know, he'd become a big feature and advocate for the gas industry in Australia. And so he does have a big set of achievements that he leaves behind him. Now, the nature of the of his leaving, which was very abrupt, to my mind, does suggest that there's been a misalignment between him and Sheffield. which is the US-based primary financial backers and one of the largest owners of Tambran. And what we've actually seen here with the installation of Scott Sheffield onto the board is a sign that the Sheffields are taking control of Tambran at this point and are going to be much more hands-on and driving things forward. I think you will see them bring a much more American lens to the Australian oil and gas sector in the Northern Territory. It is actually a sign of confidence and a further endorsement of their belief in the Beetaloo.
You mentioned a misalignment between Joel Riddle and Sheffield. Misaligned on what?
There are some signs here. I mean, first of all, obviously the Tambran share price has been languishing for some time, which will be a source of frustration to the major investors. They've had a set of mixed results, including obviously some negatives over a period of time. And I also think, you know, it's the Sheffields have a very kind of different American-centric approach to the way oil and gas will be developed, which is quite different to the way things Australia have done it. And they might want to be bringing that approach and rolling it out here in a way that perhaps Joel wasn't fully on board with. There's also, I mean, Joel's been quite a loud advocate in the industry with, you know, the recent election in Australia, which has really cemented Labor government at a federal level in a very strong way. Perhaps there's also a bit of appetite for a reset, maybe even an Australian, a more Australian face to come in when they find a new CEO is going to be able to mend some bridges and reach out more strongly with the federal government.
Well, that was going to be my next question. Why now? Why has this happened now? As you say, it was a seemingly abrupt decision. So do you think there's some other factors happening in other areas, such as politics, that might have led into this decision?
Look, it could be. That's what the timing aligns with that. Look, I think, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if, again, with that US-centric approach by the Sheffields, they're looking at a more kind of collaborative, integrated way to develop the Beetaloo with other companies there, which might have been a slightly different approach to the way Joel was pursuing things. You know, overall, this change is still a little bit messy from a governance perspective because, like, for example, Scott Sheffield, who's been installed on the board, his son Brian Sheffield is associated with a company called Daly Waters Energy, which is both a JV partner with Tambran and competes with Tambran for acreage in the Northern Territory. So there's some kind of governance issues and conflicts that will need to be managed there. But optically, it can certainly look a little bit messy. You know, but I think from an investor point of view, that's what they're going to be looking at here. While it's, again, it does look someone with the caliber of Scott Sheffield. Like if you look at his background, he's the kind of person who can join the board of much larger companies than Tambran. And the fact that he's focusing on Tambran is a good sign of an endorsement in what Tambran's doing. But the way this has happened and it's so abrupt and the conflicts that potentially are involved here, you know, they kind of cloud that with make it a bit muddy, I think, particularly to market size.
Well, Tambaran's first commercial gas sales are expected out of the Beetaloo Basin within a year. I think the target is mid-2026. Is any of this disruption within the leadership going to have any potential impacts on the production timeline or have any impact on operations?
Well, it looks like they're going to continue to invest here. I think, though, that actually does highlight probably maybe one of the areas of difference. You know, the run to early production by Tambran was something that, you know, that probably wasn't very economic, but it was done to demonstrate revenue to the investor base here. But again, that's a very different way to the way the US focused players would do this, where they're going to be much more focused on proving up the size of the acreage and the viability of the play, and then ultimately potentially like selling out to a much bigger player down the line. So I actually think that, you know, that project, which I think we'll still be proceeding with, you know, but the fact that they pursued it to begin with is a kind of sign of the differences of approach between, you know, the Sheffielders who now control compared to what we had previously.
Is there any chance that Tamboran could move away from its Beetaloo operations with a change in leadership?
I think Tamboran is 100% staying in the Beetaloo. If it was ambitions by major shareholders to do something elsewhere, they've got other vehicles to pursue that. Tamboran looks to be very much cemented in the Northern Territory as a Beetaloo play.
And who will they be looking for in their next CEO? The chair of the board of directors is the interim CEO. The company says it's on the hunt for a new permanent chief. Who will they be looking for to fill that role?
Well, I think they'd be looking for a few things. First of all, obviously being able to have a good relationship and alignment with the major shareholders. Secondly, someone who knows how to deal with key stakeholders in government, landholders and Indigenous groups. Thirdly, is going to be someone who knows how to take what's moving from an exploration phase more through to now appraisal and including some production and development and has that skill set. And finally, in my opinion, I think they might be looking for someone who has stronger ties to the Australian government, potentially is Australian themselves.
That is Saur Kavanagh, who's the head of energy research at MST Financial, speaking to Fiona Broome. This morning, the ABC asked Chief Minister Leah Fenocchiaro whether she had any concerns about Tamboran's shake-up and the future of the NT government's gas contract with that company. This was her response.
No, we that deal was done under the previous Labor government. We are continuing to look to how we can, you know, diversify and shore up gas security for Territorians into the future. And we remain very committed to the Beetaloo being a really important resource, not just for Territorians, but, you know, we can really deliver a much cleaner source of energy for the rest of this country and for our near neighbours and our allies. And so we see this as a very significant economic opportunity for the Territory to deliver jobs and prosperity for our people, and that's our focus.
That's the Chief Minister on ABC Radio this morning. As we go to air this afternoon, shares in Tamboran Resources are unchanged. They're sitting at 15 cents a share. Year to date, the company's share price has dropped by 6%. And in other chief executive resignation news, Tennant Minerals chief executive Vincent Algar, he's resigned effective as of this Thursday, the 31st of July. Mr. Algar joined the company in February last year, and according to a statement to the ASX, he is leaving to pursue other interests. Tennant Minerals says it remains focused on the development of its Bluebird copper gold project and exploration targets on its 100% owned Barkley project. It's been a tough week for CEOs.
G'day, I'm Toby. I'm Cotton Dinner in Northern Territory. You're listening to The Country Hour.
Our text number is 0487 99 1057. Angus in Alice Springs is tuning in this afternoon and says, Matt, misalignment is such a polite word. When a person gets hit in a yard by a steer, it's a misalignment. Angus, years ago, I had a misalignment with a thoroughbred. Took 3 weeks for the bruising to calm down. A big misalignment. Up next, an update on how the cotton harvest is going in the Northern Territory. You'll be hearing from the Catherine Cotton Gin. But first, let's have a song. A few days back, we got a request for a song by the Pigram Brothers, and I kept running out of time. My apologies. But here's one by them, and I hope you enjoy it. It's called Going Back Home. It is 13 to 1, and you are tuned into The Country Hour on the ABC. It's been a busy month for the Catherine Cotton Gin, with plenty of cotton coming in from Top End Farms for processing. But at the moment, the cotton bales that are coming out of the gin, they're not going then through the Darwin port. They're being trucked thousands of kilometres to the port of Brisbane for export to China. Kate Marshall from the Cotton Gin says hopefully shipments out of Darwin Port will be starting soon.
At the moment, we've done around about just a touch over 11,000 bales. We're kind of about a third of the way through the season, depending on kind of how much we get from, or if we get any from WA. But the gin's pumping out around 400 bales a shift. We did drop back from, we were running 12-hour shifts, and now we've dropped back to a 10-hour shift a day. The thing is, I guess we can kind of gin faster than the trucks can come in at the moment, but we've had a fair few in the way of trucks coming in, and then a few seed trucks going out and bale trucks going out. We've had a fair few of those. So at the moment, a lot of the bales are still heading down to Queensland, down to either Brisbane Port or down to Dalby, but hopefully that can actually change in the coming weeks. We're in the process of partnering with AWH to facilitate a bit of a warehouse out of our bale pad here. We will see more of those trucks with bales kind of way rather than down to Queensland.
So where are they going now?
Down to Dalby and then Port of Brisbane. So they're kind of getting shipped out of Brisbane. So some of them are going to Dalby to be packed into kind of their classing result ranges and things, and then out of Port of Brisbane. But hopefully we can do a bit of a shift on that in the coming weeks and they can start going out of Darwin Port.
What's the process with getting it out of the port?
Is this a matter of really figuring out the logistics and the process, kind of having service providers on board so that we can be packing containers and they've got to be kind of accredited to do so? It's more, the logistics of getting it sorted. But, having Darwin Port just up the road from a location point of view is close and convenient.
And in terms of the season, how busy has it been there?
The weather's been pretty good for picking. Like, we can't really complain. It's been, sunny days and no complaints there, so it hasn't been holding anyone up. But yield has been back a bit, so a lot of trucks and things are catching up to pickers just because the yields are back on what we and growers had expected and hoped for. So that's a little bit unfortunate, and then it obviously contributes to kind of what our output for the season might look like. But they are back a little bit this season.
And had that had any effect from the late rains we had here?
A little bit, yeah. So that like late monsoon kind of weather where we got that cloudy weather for a few weeks kind of encouraged a lot in the way of like boll rot, which is reducing the yield. And then what the yield is left, it's also reducing its quality.
Speaking of the quality, what's the quality like coming out of there now?
Very varied, actually. We've kind of had, some with some really great turnout, some with some lower turnout, and then the classing results have kind of been very varied this season. But I think that's going to be every season depending on kind of where it's grown and who's grown it and what variety. But quite the variety between the colour grades this year that are coming back and then the remainder of the classing results have also been slightly varied, but most variation would be in the colour. It just impacts the price that growers will be getting when it comes down to penalties and discounts. They'll be penalised and discounted depending on what their classing results come back as, and kind of they might, get a few deductions there.
And last time I was out there was a mountain of cottonseed in that back shed. How's that mountain of cottonseed looking now?
Good, not so much of a mountain anymore. So of what we have / will produce this year, roughly 45% will be grower retained. So even though there's sometimes a bit of a stack growing, it's not all for us to be able to sell or to move on. Growers do retain a fair chunk of it. So there's still, piles obviously ever growing as we've kind of got the gin running, but there is still seed moving out. So I've had a few locals who have been buying return buyers, and then we've got also some new buyers who have kind of emerged and looking to give cottonseed a go. So kind of a bit of a mix of people feeding it out in paddocks right through to kind of a more intensive feedlot situation.
And how many farms have picked their cotton?
So we don't have a huge amount of cotton growers as such in the territory, but the territory's most of its way through picking. And then there's only really a few who are kind of yet to start picking. But the region kind of spreads from the Douglas Daly region right down to Stuart Plateau this year.
And what are some of the learnings that you've taken from this the first two-thirds of the season into the next?
I think probably next year we might just start ginning a little bit later, kind of just let ourselves get a bit more of a stockpile before we start ginning, just to take into consideration obviously how quickly we can gin it and how much it takes for growers to try and get it into the yard. I mean, it'll very much depend on the season. If it's a bigger and better or a worse wet season, that'll obviously come into play. But we might just, regardless, make sure we've got a bit more of a stockpile of cotton before we turn it all on. Next most interesting thing will hopefully be seeing more bales go out of Darwin Port and being able to make use of having kind of facilities so close and just up the road. We're here accredited that we can be packing bales and seed into containers. So I dare say seed will also move out of Darwin Port soon, but it'd be good to see some bales heading that direction as well and save them going all the way down to Queensland and out of Brisbane.
That's Northern Cotton Grower Services Manager Kate Marshall speaking to Christine Schindler. And I've seen a few pictures from the Kimberley's Ord Irrigation Scheme. The cotton harvest has now started over there in the Ord. And the Kununurra Cotton Gin, it's having its official opening on Monday, August 11. The Country Hour will be there for that event, so stay tuned for that one.
Every day, all around Australia, extraordinary people create moments that inspire. See them, hear them. All you have to do is nominate them at australianoftheyear.org.au.
Now, there's a video doing the rounds on social media at the moment. Maybe you've seen it. It's of a crocodile getting run over at Cahill's Crossing. It's an amazing video. It shows this black four-wheel drive just coming up to the Goombalunya side of Cahill's Crossing, and you can see the ute trying to get across the river, and stuck right underneath it is this croc, sizable crocodile. It's just sort of stuck underneath it, and then the vehicle revs, and it's like it's trying to get over a big log, but it's a crocodile, and eventually it goes over the top of the croc, and it sort of heads downstream, and it's all caught on video. Rick Hind had a chat this morning to crocodile expert Professor Graham Webb and asked if a crocodile would survive getting run over like that.
That crossing, people are crossing that when there's water running over it. And in this case, it looks like the croc's been underwater and the vehicle's gone over it. But when the croc's gone to get out, it's got caught under the diff or something. And so it's when they pull up, it's sort of, it's the first time the croc's got the ability to get out from under it. And the crocs are designed to get out of, you know, not get caught underwater. So I'd be most surprised if the croc is injured in any permanent way. It's the sort of thing, they get caught under things and then they put on a real burst of energy to get out at all costs. So I doubt the croc's hurt, you know. Time will tell, you know.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. Just how tough are saltwater crocs? I can't think of too many animals that would survive being driven over.
No, look, they are tough and they've got amazing abilities to fight any infection. So that if a croc, I've often heard it said it takes a long time for crocodiles to die. In other words, sometimes when you find a croc that has been injured, usually by another croc, by battering, when it does eventually die or become sick and you open it up and you realise it's just some massive infection that has been going on for a long, long time. It's not like us where we get an infection like that, we'd roll over and die in a couple of days. Probably, you know, they have a tremendous ability. And of course, their skin, all the top parts all got bone in it, so it's very resistant to being damaged by other crocs or other things. So they're pretty well armoured. They're a great survival machine. So I doubt the croc is seriously injured by this. Certainly didn't look like it when it moved away. It just looked like 100%.
Yeah. You know. It looked pretty angry, but that was about it.
Yeah, it was going to fight like an Olympic swimmer. You know, they just turn it on at all costs to get out, you know.
Mm. So I guess when you've got a croc skin and you've got a four-wheel drive tyre, it's a bit of a debate as to which is the tougher surface.
Well, you know, it's just one of those odd things. I've never seen anything quite like that, but it doesn't surprise me. It's just, you know, having to drive through water is a dangerous thing, but up in the outback, people have got to do it all the time. And the water takes your front wheels and turns them, so you've got to be hang on like all hell. And if you you hit something or feel something, you don't let go of the steering wheel. You just hold on and keep going, you know.
That is internationally renowned croc expert Professor Graeme Webb speaking to Rick Hind this morning about that video that's going everywhere at the moment of the crocodile getting run over at Cahill's Crossing.
Hi, my name's Des Carey. I'm the manager of Killala Station. You're listening to The Country Hour. I tune in when I can to the podcast.
That's the go, Des. Hope you're doing well. Now, if you've ever wanted to check out or have a sticky beak of Bulloh River Station out near the WA border, there's an opportunity coming your way. The Department of Ag is getting ready to hold a field day out at Bulloh River on the 20th of August. This field day includes paddock tours of the famous Bulloh River. There'll be a session on how to improve your soils. There'll be an update on the Easy Pea program, which is essentially all about trying to get more phosphorus down the throats of your cattle. And the department itself will be providing updates on a bunch of its research projects. So there you go, a chance to get out to Bulloh River, a beautiful property in a remote part of the NT. But by golly, it's beautiful. There's a chance to head along now if you're keen. The 20th of August is the date. For more details, get in contact with the NT Department of Ag.
Hello, my name's Tom Barra. I'm a ranger over on Groot Island, and you're listening to The Country Hour.
Matt Brown with you this afternoon. There are calls today for a Senate inquiry into the decision to expand market access for US, Canadian and Mexican beef. I'll tell you more about that in just a moment. You'll also learn about how a deal came about to sell Droughtmaster heifers from the Alice Springs region into the Philippines.
The purchaser was very, very strong on his selection criteria. The cattle shaped up very well, were very well bred, and a credit to the breeders.
Lots coming up in this second half. We've also been talking about crocodiles. Perhaps you've seen this video of a ute at Cahill's Crossing running over a large crocodile. The croc just seems so stuck underneath it for so long. I've got a text here from Jack who says, Matt, having worked in Arnhem Land for 17 years, I'm very familiar with using Cahill's Crossing and have seen many, many crocs there. However, the first thing I did upon arrival at Cahill's was to check the height and speed of the East Alligator River, which was far more scary than the crocs. Don't tell me you got in the water, did you, Jack? Is that what you're saying here in this text? He says the reptiles come later if you lose your vehicle in the mighty alligator. That's Jack this afternoon on 0487 991057. Stay out of the water. Let's go to the Weather Bureau. Billy Lynch is there this afternoon. How are you, Billy?
Yeah, good. Thanks, Matt.
Still a bit of cloud and some humidity in parts of the top end. How long is that likely to last for?
Yeah, well, until Friday is the short answer. We're seeing cooler, drier southwesterlies push into southern and central parts today as the ridge slowly strengthens. So ahead of that, that's where the humidity is, so the northeast Barkly, the Carpentaria, and up into the top end. So, yeah, this afternoon and tomorrow, until Friday, expecting isolated showers in the top end. Interestingly, as the southeasterly surge develops Thursday night into Friday, pushing into the top end, we do think that will kick off a few extra showers. So Thursday night's looking really interesting rainfall-wise, actually, in the top end. But still a few days out. We can talk more about that in the days to come.
It is interesting, though. I'm just looking at the seven-day forecast for Catherine. And yes, Thursday, partly cloudy, medium chance of showers. There's definitely a chance of rain in the Barkly later in the week. Can you give us an update on that, Billy Lynch?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So although we'll get the dry southeasterlies pushing through the Barkly over the next few days, we're also going to get a cloud band develop and bring some rain. So we'll start to see the cloud. Well, to be honest, there's already a bit of cloud through the Barkly now, but that will start to thicken up tomorrow. And the rain is going to mainly be from Wednesday night through Thursday. And yeah, I mean, it's not going to be heavy as such, but we do think sort of Thursday there will be sort of some persistent areas of rain develop, 1 to 5 mils, possibly 5 to 10. Mm-hmm. Yeah, for any of your listeners from yesterday, I think I did mention up to 15 millimetres, but that might be pushing it a bit now, but still, you know, a light dose of welcome rain, I'm sure.
And how widespread across the Barkly?
Well, I mean, it kind of touches the Northern Simpson. So if you sort of think roughly Tea Tree up to Elliot, and even across into maybe not quite Rabbit Flat, but parts of the Tanami, but essentially right across the Barkly is where this rain could fall.
Right. And sorry, it's coming in from the east?
No, it's I guess the moisture's coming in from the northwest.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Apologies, so yep.
That's okay. No, I didn't really explain that, but usually the cloud bands, they get the moisture from the northwest. And so that's where the rain, I mean, it's basically just forming right over the top, to be honest. It'd be the easiest way to explain it.
I think I'm with you now. So hence why there's a chance of Catherine getting a little sprinkle. The northwest cloud, it'd be the top part of that cloud band as it moves towards the Barkly.
Well, and there's actually two things going on. Yeah, so the Barkley's got the cloud band.
Yep.
But once you get north of about Elliot, it's not so much about the cloud band. It's the southeasterly surge colliding with all the humidity in the top end, which is going to kick off some showers. So two mechanisms, but the result will feel the same. Either something will be falling on you or not.
I am with you now, and I hope our audience is too. It's an interesting week. Is there anything else that we need to be aware of?
No, I think that's about it for now.
No worries. Or actually, can I ask you just about cloud cover over the next day or so, just off the back of this news of two massive meteor showers that are expected to converge in the skies above Australia this week, peaking tomorrow night, according to ABC News.
Ah.
Will there be clear skies for people to watch? And I'll directly quote here from ABC News. If skies are clear, people can expect to see a steady stream of star streaks and slow-moving fireballs.
Fascinating. Well, yeah, I mean, I mentioned that cloud band developing. So south of Tea Tree, probably pretty good chance you're going to get some clear skies. But north of Tea Tree and up into the top end, there is a risk that there will be some pesky cloud cover to interfere with all of that.
Okay. All right, then. Slow-moving fireballs.
Wow. Wouldn't mind seeing that.
That sounds amazing. Is that the technical term? I don't know. All right. Thanks for your time this afternoon, Billy. Appreciate it.
No worries. Thank you.
It is 11 past one.
I'm Denny.
I'm Bridie.
I'm Eric.
I'm Bridget.
I'm Gage.
We're from Down Station and you're listening to the Country Hour.
US President Donald Trump says the minimum 10% tariff that's been imposed on trading partners like Australia could soon double. Speaking at a press conference in Scotland, the US President said he was planning a new tariff for the world. Have a listen.
We've made a lot of deals in the last couple of months. And then ultimately, as you might as well know, we're going to just... Because we have, you know, you have 200 countries, more. But people don't know that. You got a lot of countries. And but we're going to be setting a tariff for essentially the rest of the world. And that's what they're going to pay if they want to do business in the United States. I would say it'll be somewhere in the 15 to 20% range.
So maybe 15 or 20 or...
No, I said, you know, I sort of know... I just want to be nice. I would say in the range of 15 to 20%.
So there you go, exports of Australian red meat are currently dealing with a 10% tariff. Could that soon go higher? We'll have to wait and see. In a statement, a spokesperson for Trade Minister Don Farrell said, "Our position is unchanged. Any tariffs on Australian goods are unjustified and an act of economic self-harm. We will continue to engage at all levels to advocate for the removal of all tariffs in line with our free trade agreement with the United States." You forget that sometimes, that we actually have a free trade agreement with the US. Meanwhile, the August 1 deadline is looming large for Brazil, which is facing a 50% tariff on all of its exports to the US. Brazil has been selling a lot of beef to America this year, but according to analyst Brett Stewart, if that Brazilian beef faces a higher tariff, it will become an unviable trade.
You know, every one of these big announcements has ripple effects throughout the markets and throughout the world. This is a big one, Matt. 50% tariffs on imported beef from Brazil to the US will compound against the 26.4% tariffs, taking it to 76% tariffs. Now, that's untenable. That's unworkable. This is as of August 1st. If Brazil doesn't find a way out of this, on August 1st, Brazilian beef exports to the U.S. will halt. And what happens then? As you know, we've got record high 90% lean trimmings price. We're record high. All of a sudden, overnight, New Zealand, Australian beef prices see sharp demand. If Brazilian beef is no longer flowing to the U.S., these importers are going to be turning much more aggressively to Australia, New Zealand, and others. And it would be a sharp increase in bid price for imported 90s.
It's Brett Stewart from Global AgriTrends speaking to me recently. It could be awful for Brazil. It could be an opportunity for Australia. August 1, that's this Friday. Meanwhile, there are moves in Canberra today to force a Senate inquiry into the decision to expand access for US, Canadian and Mexican beef into Australia. The Nationals are pushing for this inquiry, claiming they've found evidence that the Director of Biosecurity back in March was recommending an independent review on all of this, but it never happened. Here's the leader of the Nationals and Shadow Ag Minister, David Littleproud.
Well, we're looking to get a Senate inquiry up. We're trying to get the Greens to support it. And I think it's the sensible way forward, considering the evidence that continues to mount, that this looks to be a decision predicated on time and on getting Anthony Albanese a meeting with President Trump without looking at the proper scientific reasons nor processes, not only in the decision-making, but in terms of giving us comfort around the traceability of livestock that may have originated in Mexico or in South America or Canada coming to this country through the United States, and in fact, making sure there's good governance around that decision.
Will there be a Senate inquiry? Will you get the support you need to make it happen?
Well, we hope that the Greens can see this. I mean, we have now unearthed that the Inspector General of Biosecurity in this country in March this year made a recommendation to the minister, which the government and the department has accepted, that when they're making these risk assessments, an independent scientific panel should peer review and oversight them. That's what we said from day one, considering the fact that this is a process that's been going on for close to a decade. And yet on the day that they announced that they're going to allow this beef to come in, they had not done the work to provide the protocols of the way in which that beef could be brought in this country. That says to me the department is catching up to a deal that Kevin Rudd has done running around Washington for Anthony Albanese, all at our expense. And this is not just about the cattle industry. Every Australian should be worried about this. This is protecting us from diseases like tuberculosis, from mad cow disease.
So the Inspector General of Biosecurity asked the government for a scientific review on this issue?
No, more broadly. And they made that in March, which the department accepted as a process that should be included.
So on all imports?
using under the risk assessment model, that those decisions made by the department, as a matter of prudence, there should be a scientific advisory group formed and overviewing these decisions to make sure that they have been done with the best science.
The Prime Minister says he is using scientific advice and the Nationals are the ones politicising the issue. This is the Prime Minister's words on Insiders on the ABC on the weekend.
The agency that looked at this, the department, independently of government, this wasn't a political decision. They looked at it, said they've satisfied the requirements.
Nonetheless, the industry here still has concerns. They want more detail and they want a review, an independent technical review of the decision. Will they get one?
Well, be very clear. The industry, on the morning of the decision, they were consulted beforehand. They knew the decision was coming and on the morning gave an interview on ABC Radio that backed in the decision. Mm-hmm. Then the National Party decided to politicise the issue.
Oh, so you think the industry has been led by the National
Party? Well, the National Party decided to politicise the issue. These issues are really serious.
Mm.
And
will there be a review?
I certainly understand. There has been a review. It's taken 10 years.
The government says they've done a 10-year review that's involved scientific evidence and that's enough and you're politicising this issue.
Well, two things here on this. First is they've accepted the fact that we should have an independent scientific body review these decisions. Anthony Albanese's own government, he's simply saying he's relying on the department. His own Inspector General is saying, no, you should have a peer review of those decisions. So we're not politicising. And then to say that the industry groups are being led by the National Party just is pure contempt for those groups. They are independent of us. But let me tell you, they got fear put through them like I did. When I got the briefing the morning after they made the decision, it was frightening. They could not tell me the traceability model that they would have for these cattle that originated in Mexico or Nicaragua or anywhere else that may come through Mexico. They couldn't tell me, was there a withholding period of these cattle that might come to the US? Did they have to be on feed for a number of period of days in the United States? There was no traceability. There was no understanding that they could provide me. In fact, the minister said in Parliament that she'd sent me the protocols that afternoon after I had that briefing and got nothing. The protocols she sent me was not the ones the department had created because they hadn't been created yet. She sent me the protocols between the United States and Mexico, United States and Canada. So this government is doing this on the run.
That's Leader of the Nationals, David Littleproud, speaking to Warwick Long. The Federal Ag Minister, Julie Collins, has been contacted for comment.
Charles Vaughan here, Australian Cattle Enterprises and Charles Vaughan Veterinary Services. I'm here today at Berrima Export Yards and you're listening to The Country Hour.
On beef imports, I've got a text here that says, if it's not in a tin, don't let it in. What is wrong with the Australian government? Well, how about this? 900 Droughtmaster heifers from the Northern Territory are now settling into their new homes in the Philippines. These heifers were handpicked from stations in Central Australia to be part of a breeding program. Steve Gaff was the stock agent behind this deal. He had a chat to Charles Geary about how it all came about.
An exporter approached me early in the year with a request for some very well-bred red heifers, droughty-type heifers, for an order that he had to go over there. I sort of rang a couple of my good clients who were running Droughtmaster cattle and had a few available at the time. When they came back to us with the price and delivery date, we then sort of started to put the two together and get the logistics worked out.
And was this something that you're aware may be on the cards for a while now, or did this request come out of the blue a little bit?
Look, this is not a common thing. I think there is a lot of cattle do go to the Philippines out of the eastern states. This one was more around trying to find some good lines of red cattle out of Central Australia for this particular buyer.
And talk to us a bit about the selection process for those cattle. How did you pick the cattle that ended up making that trip over to the Philippines?
We had a weight range we had to operate within, guidelines and obviously confirmation type, etc. They were the main issues, and then once we put the cattle together, what we thought would suit them, they then sent a vet out. We pre-tested the heifers, and the Filipino buyers had a had a selector on hand who went back through them and double-checked and took the cattle they wanted to take for it. The purchaser was very, very strong on his selection criteria, and we had to make sure that the cattle we put up to them were what they wanted, and they were very... went through the cattle pretty well and very picky, but very fair with the way they selected cattle and obviously around that preg test status as well, which is also part of the quarantine protocol.
And from your point of view, how were those Droughtmaster cattle looking as they started making that way over to the eastern seaboard?
Mate, the cattle that we selected were come from pretty good herds of cattle, and I know the cattle very well. They drafted up and selected very well. I've been selling cattle from those couple of places for a few years now and get a pretty good look at the way their herds improved and moving along, and their second heifers that they sold were very good heifers, would line up anywhere. And another large mob we got out of south of Alice Springs, we went through quite a few heifers to get the right ones down there as well, but again, that was just to fill up our order. So yeah, the cattle shaped up very well, very well bred, and a credit to the breeders.
Is this an opportunity that you think other Centralian breeders might be able to take advantage of as well?
Mate, it is if you've got Droughtmaster heifers. You know, it was a droughty or red cattle order. I mean, the specific orders go out for Herefords, for Angus and Brahmins, and this one just happened to be for droughty, so it's purely around that was all the boy I wanted, so yeah.
Are you hearing of any other opportunities for maybe some of those other breeds that we have here in Central Australia?
Oh, mate, there's always opportunities for every breed. I mean, I know at the moment there's orders going around for Hereford heifers going into some different articles, and Angus heifers is always orders for them. So, Charles, it just varies from shipment to shipment, which particular exporter has an order going for what country they're going into and what their selection criteria is.
And for other Centralian producers maybe looking to get into this space, do you have any advice for them looking to get into this space?
I think the best thing they can do is if they're talking to the agent that they're dealing with, he will keep them informed of what orders there are going around for particular breeds and where they're going. And if the agent's got a relationship with an exporter, obviously they'll get rung about it first, and that's kind of how it works. You know, it's just a matter of when the exporter picks his agent to deal with in the particular area, he'll put the order out to whoever has those particular cattle.
You had a pretty busy month this month, obviously, with the Alice Springs show and the cattle sale. What's happening in your world now that particularly busy period is starting to come to an end?
Yeah, look, it was, July was a great month. We had a heap on. The show sale was absolutely outstanding. It was a credit to all the vendors of all the cattle that lined up there on the day and the agents involved. It was a great day and a great sale. We've been busy with a few other little bits and pieces going on. We've got a lot of kill cattle booked in to go in August, so that's sort of going to keep us fairly busy. Quite a few slaughter cattle moving at the moment, obviously, so that's kind of our focus at the minute on that. And a few little store jobs, all the rain in the eastern states will kick that job along a bit. So we just look at, you know, marketing off the back of the upswing down there.
That is Steve Gaff from Red Centre Rural speaking to Charles Geary about that order from the Philippines, 900 Droughtmaster heifers from the Alice Springs region heading over there. The cattle market is starting to pick up as the weather warms up in southern parts of this nation. We'll find out how prices fared at Roma next.
Your Burke is sensational.
It's not okay to have a crush on your agent, is it?
Michael Theo returns in the heartwarming new season of Austin.
I'm not going to let fame change me.
Sunday nights on ABC TV and ABC iView.
It is time now on the Country Hour to head to the sale yards of all the latest prices out of Roma. Here is a rugged up David Friend.
A very frosty Tuesday where Roma agents yarded reduced numbers to 7,290 head. Or the regular process of feline background is present and inactive with 2 to 3 extra southern operators. At the time of this interim report, the market deer for all categories. Yearling steers under 200 kilos topping at 5.35 cents a kilo. Yearling steers 200 to 280 kilo sold from 360 to 496 cents a kilo. Yearling steers 280 to 330 kilos made to 482. Yearling steers 330 to 400 improved, the majority selling from 390 to 433 cents a kilo. Yearling steers 400 to 480 kilos made to 418 to feed. Rowan steers at 500 to 600 kilos sold at 415, and Grower steers over 600 kilos to 420 cents a kilo. This has been David Friend from the National Livestock Reporting Service at Roma.
Thank you for that, David. In the live export trade, feeder steers to Indonesia are getting about $3.30 to $3.40 a kilo. The feeder heifers are getting about $3 a kilo. From what I can tell, there's about five live export ships due out of Darwin Port between tomorrow and next Tuesday, so a busy time for the live export trade. And as mentioned, the weather is starting to warm up in southern parts of the nation. There's been some noticeable rain in the last week or so, and the cattle market appears to be responding to that. As we go to air this afternoon, for example, the feeder heifer indicator is 27 cents a kilo better than this time last week. The dairy cow indicator is 25 cents a kilo in front of this time last week. Processor cow indicator is up 22 cents. Feeder steer indicator up 6 cents a kilo on this time last week. There's a lot of green shoots in the cattle market at the moment, which will be a pleasing sight for beef producers. If you missed the start of today's Country Hour, then you missed our stories about the tough week it's been for chief executives. The CEO of Tamboran Resources, Joel Riddle, is gone. The chief executive of Tennant Minerals is resigning on Thursday. And the chief executive of the National Farmers Federation, Troy Williams, has only been in the gig for 4 months. He's gone as well. If you missed any of that, it's up on our podcast later on this afternoon. Keep it rural.